Hey, everyone. Welcome to Neighbor Science, the only political economy podcast that's also about anime. But not today. Today, we are talking about political economy. I guess in a way. I don't know. Today, we're talking about high net worth individuals and billionaires. Really, millionaires and billionaires. Let's just say that.
Yeah, let's do that, because otherwise I'm going to keep having the term Henwee running through my head.
Yeah. Yeah, so this is going to be based on two annual reports, one by Capgemini called the World Wealth Report, which is about high net worth individuals, or Henwees, as I like to call it, because it sounds like a rich guy getting like dommed, you know, by someone like who puts him in a baby outfit and like calls him Henwee. Makes him go pee pee and poo poo in his diapy. The other one is by WealthX, and it's called the Billionaire Census.
Which they've actually been doing for several years now. I highly recommend that people check out the WealthX Billionaire Census.
Yeah, so the World Wealth Report has been going since 1999, and the Billionaire Census has been going on since 2013.
Yeah.
So they have quite a few editions. So I was actually able to get quite a bit of data from the two reports and play around with it in a spreadsheet, which I found some pretty interesting things from that. So we'll be talking about that too.
Okay, so without any further ado.
Yeah. Yeah, so we'll start with the World Wealth Report. And before we get into it, we need to define high net worth individual. So when we think of like someone who's a millionaire, we kind of don't have a, you know, really precise definition of it. It's just like someone who has $1 million. But, you know, by our definition, like our common definition, that would most likely include someone who has like $1 million house. You know, because they have $1 million to spend, essentially. That's like what, how we think of it. But for people in the finance industry, people whose customers are these people, they have a very specific definition. So a high net worth individual is defined as an individual who owns at least $1 million in investable assets. So that means that they have $1 million, not including their house or other real property. So they have $1 million that they can take and put into some sort of investment. It's not locked into anything like property or anything like that. So they also, they have like, you know, that's like the general definition of any high net worth individual. But they have a number of, you know, classes within that. So they also have mid-tier millionaires. That's anyone with 5 million to 30 million in investable assets. And then they have what's called ultra high net worth individuals, which is anyone with $30 million or more in investable assets. So we can like we can look at the characteristics of each group. So the lowest end of the millionaire category is called millionaires next door. That's that's like their colloquial name for it, I guess. So that's someone with $1 to $5 million in investable assets. That's 90% of millionaires are in this group. They also have 43% of millionaire wealth, and they have 43% of millionaire wealth and a 7.2% growth rate. I think that's what that means. CAGR, pretty sure.
Yeah.
Probably should have defined that because I wasn't going to remember it. But anyway, so the next group is the mid-tier millionaires. That's the $5 to $30 million. These are only 9% of the total. They have 22% of total millionaire wealth and a 7.2% growth rate. And then we get to the $30 million plus people. These are only 1% of the total, but they have 34.5% of all millionaire wealth and a 5.4% growth rate from 2010 to 2015.
So, like, if we were to break this down, it actually breaks down very similarly to the way the actual wealth distribution for the full population of the planet. But it's kind of an analog, where your 1% at the top still control like 40% almost of everything.
Yeah, it's the 80-20 rule, basically. And you know, everyone knows the 1% by now. And you hear a lot of people, you know, it's kind of the random commenter who just seems a little off or whatever, always going on about the real 1%, which is the 0.01%. But this shows that that's actually quite true. The 1% of millionaires owns the majority of, or the plurality of, millionaire wealth. Well, I guess it's not the plurality, but still, they own a crazy amount of the wealth for the size of the group.
Yeah, yeah. I suppose my big question here, right off the bat, would be because I don't quite know what the PPP of the US is. So I'm not sure. How far does $1 million take you in the US?
Oh, I see what you're saying. It really, really depends on geography. Because, you know, like, my parents were talking about someone who lived in, they met abroad, that had a house in Spain, and they bought it for, I think they said, like, 100-something thousand pounds. And it was like this huge house with a big yard, like in a nice, really nice part of Spain. And it had a pool, and they did all these renovations to it. In the U.S., a really crappy townhouse, like in this area, crappy townhouse in the, like, one of the crappiest areas that you can live in, is about $300,000.
Okay.
Yeah. So $1 million can get you not very far, if you're in the right areas. And I think rents around here are only like, it's like half of what it is in New York City, and then like a third or a quarter of what it is in like San Francisco. Okay. So basically, but it depends on the local, like, property laws, I guess, and like building codes and all that stuff, and then how many rich people are in your area.
I had just asked the question of whether or not the 1 to 5 million, the neighbor, the millionaire next door, are they considered upper class or upper middle class? Where would they fall within the U.S. view?
Yeah, I mean, I think if you're in a, you know, a really expensive area, I would say just upper middle class. But if you're in, you know, the Midwest, you're like probably very upper class.
Okay.
And
obviously, this is why I said it's a bit of a reach. And contextually speaking, it just means that whether it's lower upper class or upper middle class, that you've still got that region of class being covered by 90% of high net worth individuals.
Yeah.
And like I can't help but feel like it sort of means that you need to reclassify the classes in order to say that, look, your upper middle class, anyone that is even in the 1 to 5 million, technically should just be relabeled upper class for convenience purposes.
Yeah, I mean, I think basing classes on you know, dollar amounts is going to be inherently rife with issues because of the whole cost of living difference. You know,
yeah.
$1 million goes a lot farther in you know, Richmond
in Detroit,
than it does
in
New York City. Yeah. So like most other economic metrics, you know, for determining people's living situation, I think the best measure would be you know, giving how many hours they would have to work in order to achieve the same standard of living as the average person in their area. I guess probably in their city would be the best one to do, but in their country would be fairly good as well. So, you know, if we know that, like, Howard Schultz, the CEO of Starbucks, he only has to work 1 hour to have the same standard of living as any of his lowest employees, because he makes about $16,000 an hour.
Jesus.
So, and the standard of living of a Starbucks rank and file worker is not very high. So.
And then I'm also just looking at the trading economics page where they list the PPP for the US, and I mean, even that, it varies literally so broadly from year to year. Back in 2009, it was under the 50,000 mark. Now it's sitting closer to the 54,000 mark, and it's really difficult to even like say that the US PPP, which is obviously an average of all the states put together, even that, it's not very indicative of much.
Right. Yeah, and PPP is not even, I really question its validity as a way to compare, you know, wages and cost of living between different countries. But we don't have to get into that.
Yeah, the only reason I'm bringing it up is because I keep thinking of China. Mm. And, you know, China, in sheer volume, their economy still isn't quite as big as the U.S. But I think it's like 2 years or 3 years ago that they were that they basically surpassed the US in PPP.
Mm.
So, and I mean, they're the same size as the US geographically, but their PPP is it works a lot better when you're generalizing across the country. They don't have these vast differences that you have between the Midwest and New York City.
Not yet.
Yeah, obviously. And I mean, it's a rapidly changing society. But I do find it interesting that right now you can go look at their PPP, and the national average is not that far off from the averages taken from region to region. I can't remember exactly where I read about it, so I can look for the links, but I'm not sure I'll find them. But yeah, it was just a point of interest for me.
Yeah.
Sorry, I didn't mean to derail. I am known for derailment, but I will try to cease and desist.
All right. So back to millionaires. High net worth individuals have a very high rate of return on investments. So the S&P 500 had a 9.9% gain return on investments for 2017. The high net worth individual class had a 24.3% global average. So many
that's
of them had much higher than that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Wow. Which is that's an incredible rate of return. Let's see. Henwys have increasing trust in the wealth management industry. So I guess to make it clear, there's an entire industry that is devoted to basically maintaining the class disparity, maintaining or increasing. So if you were rich enough, you don't even have to like be a smart investor to become much richer. You can just pay someone to do it for you. And in fact, the wealth management industry is much better at, you know, getting these good investments than basically any millionaire. So, like, there's no reason not to do this.
If I could afford it, I probably wouldn't do it. I'm not gonna lie. I'm pretty decent at doing research on various things and linking disparate points of interest that at first glance don't seem like they're linked, but upon closer inspection you can sort of like draw a narrative that leads to a conclusion. I'm not terrible at that, but I don't have access to the kind of data mining and the sheer volume of labor being thrown at investment as the wealth management industry does. And so it only makes sense to give them your money and tell them, well, make it grow.
Yeah.
And if they don't, then you give it to someone else and eventually it grows. So.
Yeah. I mean, they have all these tools and experience and manpower, and their livelihood depends on them making you money. So they're very good at it.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's, I've
told you before about the series Billions. I don't know if you've ever listened to me and actually watched it.
Not yet, no.
The billionaires in that show are all wealth management people. So, it's a really good show. You need to watch it.
Yeah,
God,
I know.
Damn it, Ryan. You just don't listen to me.
I just haven't been watching TV.
Oh, that's actually good. Don't listen to me. Don't watch TV. It's bad for you.
I was watching Futurama yesterday while I was doing notes for this, but that's because I've watched it, like, literally the entire series at least 10 times. So it's just, like, background for me. For 2017, 93% of millionaires had positive returns in their portfolios, and only 5% lost money. So the idea that some people have, well, probably a lot of people in this country have, is that, you know, you can lose your millions just as easily as you can get them. There's this whole thing. I think it's from the Cato Institute, where when they talk about social mobility, they look at social mobility within a single person's lifetime, which is, of course, the stupidest way to do it, because obviously inheritance exists. And, you know, social connections exist and education exists and social mobility happens much more on the intergenerational level than on the intragenerational level. But, according to them, most people like start off in the lower middle class and then get into the upper class at some point during their lives and then go back to the lower class. This is the narrative that they've been crafting for years. And of course their definition of upper class is like the top quintile, which you're in if you make over, I think it was like $160,000 or something, like some really low number. And according to them, that's the upper class. But, someone who makes that much would probably not have like any money to invest in anything really.
Yeah.
So
I'm going to look at that whole theory and go, shut the fuck up, Cato.
Yeah, so if we look at the actual upper class, the millionaires, then 93% of them become more of a millionaire, and only 5% of them lose money. And that's not even to say that they are not millionaires anymore. so, yeah, that's wrong. I mean, I think we all knew, but it's interesting to see just how wrong it is. So millionaires next door, the lowest class of millionaire, have less trust of regulatory bodies than ultra henwies or unwies. I think this might be because millionaires on the lower end are actually at greater risk of losing wealth to regulation, or at least like not gaining wealth as fast because of regulation, whereas the ultra high net worth people are most likely the primary beneficiaries of regulation because they're the ones that own the big businesses that, you know, kind of determine what regulation looks like and get a secure position in their market created by you know, increased regulation causing like a higher barrier to entry into that industry.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's actually a complaint that people have been having about, what is this, European privacy law?
Oh, the GDNR or whatever.
Yeah, yeah. That's like, I keep seeing that from chuds, like, this is going to raise barriers to entry to business and make it harder for small businesses. Like, no, any
really,
fucking small business is going to be, like, breaking into the social networking industry or something like that. It's just crazy.
The funny thing is, the first two victims, it's been all over my news feed, the first two victims of the GDNR have been Google and Facebook.
Yeah, no shit.
Like, come on, people. Fucking get real.
Yeah.
So, for the record, there I was just talking to people that don't listen to our show. So, for those of you that are listening, you are not part of the people that I am calling people.
Okay. So there's a section in here where they talk about the future of the wealth management industry, and there's a concern by the authors who are wealth management industry people. Excuse me. That the massive and powerful tech industry, particularly Google, Amazon, Facebook, Apple, and then Alibaba and Baidu, the two Chinese companies, could disrupt the wealth management industry by getting into it themselves. So they polled millionaires about having their wealth managed by some of these companies, and over half were open to the idea. They went deeper into it, asking them like specific questions about their expectations and concerns for each. So the top expectation with 64% of respondents was efficiency, so service speed and convenience, and then transparency following that, fee structure and performance, that was 54%. The top concerns were privacy and security of my personal data at 53%, and a completely digital offering that does not offer human interaction, which was 46%. So millionaires really want to talk to a person, at least, you know, for a part of what they do with their wealth management company.
Oh my God. So what you're saying is they don't want their bank to reduce them to nothing more than a number.
Yeah, imagine that.
Interestingly, Alibaba, which was part of the list of companies that you mentioned there.
Yep.
They last year, I think it was July, August, there or thereabouts, they backed a private bank that was set up in Hong Kong, specifically designed as a wealth management fund. So,
interesting.
Yeah, I don't think they're too concerned about that. I'm trying to remember what it's called. I'm sure I've got it here somewhere.
Yeah, well, Jack Ma has actually said that he hopes for Alipay, their payment service, to become China's largest bank. So he's really aiming to break into that industry, like, very explicitly.
Okay, so it's called DC Wealth.
Okay.
Which is a strange name. Brilliant. It's brilliant. I love it.
Yeah. So there seems to be a lot more hype than fear about the idea of the tech industry breaking into the wealth management business. You know, people raise these privacy concerns, but if there's anything we learned about privacy in the 21st century, it's that the convenience and cost of tech industry services far outweighs the loss of privacy to the vast majority of people. Most people just don't care that much. You know, maybe millionaires care more because they actually like have more power to refuse to give up their privacy. But I think generally people value having stuff a lot more than they value not having people know what they're doing with their stuff. The favorability for tech industry wealth management is much higher for Henwis under 40 and Henwis in Southeast Asia, which probably makes the whole thing a lot scarier to the authors because these groups are both the future of the industry. So a poll of wealth management executives finds that most, as in around 75%, think that wealth management by the tech industry is likely to happen in the future. And so, as I mentioned, Alibaba, they've already gotten into the finance industry. In 2004, it was doing online and mobile payment, which I think that's what Alipay is. And then later it started to run its own money market fund, and it now has a marketplace for financial products from banks.
Okay. So kind of like a stock exchange.
Kind of, but I think it's from stuff from commercial banks.
Yeah.
Not so much stocks. Probably like assets and derivatives and that kind of shit.
Yeah.
Let's see. So I have this section here that I've already maybe touched on a little bit. I guess it kind of doesn't make sense in context, but I'll just go into it anyway. So there's a number of problems with measuring the distribution of wealth in capitalism. We've already mentioned a couple, like purchasing power parity and the cost of living in the area. Another one is the use of quintiles or deciles. So a lot of these measurements look at, you know, the top 10% versus the top bottom percent, the bottom 10%. But the problem there is, you know, the bottom 10% goes from like, you know, $0 to like $7,000 or whatever it is, in whatever country it is. But the top decile goes from the lower limit of that decile, so like, you know, $400,000 to infinity. So the distribution of the income is very tail heavy on the upper end, which means, you know, within that top decile, there's going to be a whole nother nested distribution that looks like the overall distribution, as we already mentioned. So there's vastly greater difference between the min max of the top quantile than between the min max of the bottom quantile. So basically,
the numbers, when you're working with quintiles and quantiles and deciles and all of that, the numbers are very misleading.
Yeah.
And so your general population, who are not that well versed on statistics and don't really know what it is that they're looking at, they can be very easily misled. And obviously, the mass media tends to go with what seems the simplest and what people will easily understand. But what people will easily understand, obviously, like we're saying now, is it's very non-representative of what's actually going on.
Yeah, and there's not much incentive for them to use a more accurate number because they love painting this narrative that there's no distinct class system here, and the use of quintiles easily supports this because any numbers using quintiles, you know, puts the like slightly upper middle class people that make $100,000 a year in the same category as Mark Zuckerberg and Jeff Bezos,
who are just, you know, they're just average working stiffs, you know.
Yeah, you know, they go to work, they clock in, they clock out. Same thing.
Yeah,
same
yeah,
as you
they
and me.
Also, they also struggle to unionize, you know?
Yeah. Can you imagine if there was a fucking billionaires union?
Jesus Christ. I was literally just picturing that, and then I realized it exists. It's called a fucking country club.
Yeah. So the other problem that I have here is income and wealth. Both income and wealth matter. So measures of social inequality tend to focus on income inequality, without much or any attention on wealth inequality. So if someone owns capital and it appreciates in value, it's a gain in wealth, but it's only considered income and therefore a contribution to social inequality when the capital is sold and turned into income. And then the other issue is like the average wealth of a person in the US is like negative numbers because most people are in huge amounts of debt and don't have any savings. I think it was something like 80% of Americans have less than $4,000 in savings.
Jesus.
Which, I mean, $4,000 can easily be wiped out by like a couple bad coincidences. Like, you wreck your car and have to go to the hospital. That's like easily more than $4,000. Out of your bank account. So most people in the US are very much in a precarious position and don't have any actual wealth to speak of. Even if you own a house, you know, if you have like 50% equity in it, it's like you own zero wealth because your debt cancels out the equity that you own. So,
Just I'm looking at something here in what's called the Democracy Journal, democracyjournal.org.
Okay.
Can't see a date on here, but the very first line reads: "In the United States, total non-financial private debt is $27 trillion, and public debt is $19 trillion." Now, I'm not sure about the accuracy of those figures, but I'm also not surprised that that is an actual amount.
Yeah, that's crazy.
I know that household debt, what was it? Household debt was 13 trillion. At the end of 2017, and that was according to the Federal Reserve of New York's, Center for Microeconomic Data. And I mean, that's nothing to sneeze at, man. $13 trillion, that's a little bit more debt than you should have as the world's only still existing, quote, superpower, unquote.
Right. So I pulled a lot of this data from the report and started working with it in a spreadsheet to see if I could figure out some alternative measures to social inequality. So I came up with a couple. I started by looking at the millionaire rate, so the number of millionaires per 100,000 people. So the results of that were fairly surprising. Number one by quite a large margin was Switzerland, which that could be because they have a higher than average level of wealth. So you're like, basically
Is
every
that
person is closer to being a millionaire than anywhere else in the world.
okay,
What were you
but
going to
is
say?
that looking at people that store their wealth in Switzerland or people in Switzerland itself?
People whose primary residence is Switzerland.
That's interesting because I know when I was living in the Cayman Islands, in the Cayman Islands, what they were doing is they had these schemes where they would get all these rich people in on timeshare properties, so that in essence they owned property there, and they could then, according to bank papers, claim it as their primary residence. But then obviously they never even set foot in the country, and they basically just used it as a tax haven.
But then
So
why wouldn't these tax havens be in the report if the methodology were susceptible to that?
I don't know. I'm not claiming that that is the way it still works. We are talking about nearly 14 years ago.
Yeah, because I mean, if you don't look at the rates, then the numbers, like if you look at the pure population numbers, then they make a lot more sense. Because like the U.S. has almost 5 million millionaires. Japan has almost 3 million. China has almost 1.2 million, but Switzerland only has 364,000.
Okay.
So it's the rate, like the incidence among the total population, that makes Switzerland the top ranked on the list.
That's interesting.
And then number two is Kuwait. So Switzerland has 4,332 millionaires per 100,000 people. Kuwait has 3,923 per 100,000 people.
Very interesting.
Yeah.
Just to be clear about why I find this interesting, first of all, I thought that, you know, that maybe it's some sort of swindle. But now that you're putting it like that, I know that in Switzerland, you know, they've got a very strong social net, a social safety net. There's no laws against drinking. Their gun laws are different, and it's a very strong society, but with I think it's pretty high levels of taxation in comparison to somewhere like the US.
Yeah, it's like 35% for the bottom bracket and 50% for the top bracket.
Yeah,
they only have two.
Yeah, and so a lot of people there they're already looked after. You know, the Swiss government looks after the people to a very high extent, and because of that, you know, a lot of them are not going to be looking to amass vast amounts of wealth. They're happy to, you know, just be normal people that live normal lives, because those lives are generally good. So it would make sense then for there to be a higher concentration of... Oh, wait, no, I'm thinking about it backwards now. I'm a dumbass.
Yeah, I mean, the GDP per capita there is $80,500, which is like, I think it's the highest on the list by a huge margin. Yeah, by like $30,000. Oh no, Norway is just behind them, 74,941. But Norway is also number three on the millionaire rate. So Kuwait is really a major exception here, where their GDP per capita is like so insanely lower than their millionaire rate.
I wonder if that... I can't think of a reason.
I don't know.
For why,
but
this
we have to
happening.
Get to we have to keep going, because I haven't even gotten to like half the stuff that I've got here.
Fair enough.
So I created a couple inequality scores, and what I did was basically I adjusted the millionaire rate to be like a ratio of. So the rate of millionaires for the country compared to the rate of millionaires for the entire world. So if there's a higher than average concentration of millionaires, it'll be above one. If there's a lower than average, it'll be below one. So if we look at that, Switzerland is almost 20 times the rate of millionaires for the world. And so the inequality score is... that number that I just said, the millionaire rate for the country per the millionaire rate for the world, divided by the GDP per capita of the country compared to the GDP per capita of the world. So if it has a higher than average GDP per capita and a lower than average... Sorry, a higher than average millionaire rate and a lower than average GDP per capita, then it'll have a much higher inequality score. So Kuwait is by far the most unequal on this list. The inequality score is 6.97. And it's followed distantly by Japan, which is 2.86. The U.S. here is surprisingly not that unequal compared in the sense of millionaires. It's only 1.21. Most Asian countries and BRICS countries are all below one. So I also did this with billionaires. I did the billionaire rate and the inequality score based on billionaires. So let's see. Where's the billionaire rate? This is per million people. So the billionaire rate, Switzerland, again, has the top spot at 10 billionaires per million people. But then Hong Kong is second with also about 10 billionaires per million people. And since I've brought up Hong Kong, I also looked at the wealth distribution for most of these countries. So one of the numbers that I calculated was billionaire wealth as a percentage of GDP. And for Hong Kong, it's 70%. The wealth of billionaires in Hong Kong is 70% of their GDP.
Wow.
Which is over twice as high as the next highest, which is Sweden at Switzerland at 33%.
Wow, that's so really divergent from the norm.
Yeah, so Hong Kong is a profoundly unequal society. I remember seeing articles that tried to bring this up, and they were showing some of the homes of the working poor there, and it's just like it's like smaller than a prison cell. It's insane. It's like the size of my bathroom, and they have a bed and a TV and like a little cooking area and just stuffed to the rafters with things because they need them all to live. But it's a 7-foot by 3-foot area. It's just crazy.
That sounds ridiculous.
Yeah. Let's see if there's anything else really interesting to talk about here. I'll actually get into the other parts later. So we can get into the billionaire census now. So again, this is by WealthX. Peter found this. Very good find. So this is the 2018 one that we'll be talking about. And they make a point right away that the expectations for the economy going into 2017 were very low, given the global political chaos that was in full swing in 2016, kind of continuing now. There was kind of a rise of fascism all over the globe. So there was an associated turmoil with that. But what actually happened in 2017 was an extremely excellent year for billionaires, with the lowest market volatility in decades. And the general opinion is that this excellent year will probably not be repeated, because not only was it an anomalously low market volatility, but there was also very low central banking interest rates, and most people think that that's coming to an end. So the authors conclude from this that billionaire wealth isn't strongly affected by the political climate. But they're basing this on an aggregate analysis, and they kind of immediately contradict themselves by pointing out that political turmoil in the UK with Brexit and in Saudi both had a negative effect on billionaire wealth. So when Americans think of political turmoil, we think of Donald Trump. That's probably the example that 90% of people here would bring up. But being that he's president of business deals, the political upset in the U.S. has been very good for billionaires. Since the U.S. is an imperial police state, the subjugation of the lower classes will usually be good for business. So, you know, someone gets paid for the LRADs, MOABs, and ICE detention centers that get used when there's the sort of political turmoil that we have in the U.S. So they publish billionaire populations both by country and by city. So the city result is pretty interesting. New York is still the home of the most billionaires at 103, but its growth rate is minuscule compared to most other cities with billionaires. So Hong Kong, for example, is number two, but they added 21 new billionaires last year. Let me see if I can get the actual number that they had there. According to the calculations I did, Hong Kong is profoundly unequal. We already talked about that. Let's see, billionaire cities. Yeah, so they now have 93 billionaires. So they're very close to overtaking New York as the number one city for billionaires. Number three is San Francisco at 74, and they added 14 new billionaires last year.
Which obviously can be attributed to Silicon Valley and you know, the whole tech industry.
Yeah. And despite the Russia conspiracy stuff, Moscow actually lost billionaires. It's down by two, and it's at 69 now.
Man, poor Russia. I feel so bad for them.
Yeah. Beijing added 19 new billionaires, and so they are now at 57. And surprisingly, there's another mainland Chinese city on here, Shenzhen, which is at 39, and that's up 16 from last year. The other ones on this list are London at number 4, Singapore at number 7, Dubai at number 8, and Mumbai at number 9, which is surprising. I didn't think India had nearly as many billionaires as a lot of other places.
Oh, no. India's got a lot of money, man. Don't even for a moment think that they aren't on that map.
Yeah. Well, I mean, for the total number of billionaires in India, it's only a sixth of the U.S. It's 104 billionaires.
Yeah. So. I do know that India has more than a million millionaires.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah. So, like, there's definitely a fair bit of money going down there.
Yeah. So, let's see. Next, they talk about the asset allocation of billionaires, which is fairly surprising. I would think they would have a lot of real estate. But I guess, you know, real estate can only be so valuable. So, real estate and luxury assets is only 3% of their total assets. In 2017, it was only 2.3%, so it was more like 2%. Their highest asset class is public holdings, which is not surprising, but then the second highest is private holdings, so they have a lot of equity in private companies, which is surprising. You don't really hear about private companies nearly as much. So I really wonder what their holdings are actually in, like what kind of companies.
Yeah.
And then about a quarter of their assets are liquid assets, or cash, basically. Which I didn't think it would be that high either.
Yeah. Like I'd be quite surprised to find out that Bezos's 100 billion, means that he's got like 25 billion in cash sitting in the back pocket.
Yeah.
Obviously, cash is a bit of a misnomer when we talk about liquid assets, but you get the idea.
Right. Money they can spend, basically.
Mm.
So they go into some demography of billionaires, which has some interesting stuff in it. So they break billionaires down by primary industry. So unsurprisingly, number one is finance, banking, and investment. That's 413 billionaires. Number two is industrial conglomerates, which is 380 billionaires. Real estate is number three at 173. Manufacturing is closely behind it at 167. And then technology is fifth at 143. They don't go into any more than that. But then what's surprising about it is that tech billionaires have a much higher average wealth than any other group. So finance, banking, and investment billionaires have about $3.4 billion on average. Technology billionaires have $6 billion on average. But the authors note that this is heavily distorted because six of the 10 richest people in the world are in the tech industry, and their fortunes are vastly higher than the average fortune. Let's see. The gender composition, also not surprising. Female billionaires are only 12% of the total population, but they do have a slightly higher growth rate, 18% versus 14.5%. So I think this is like one of the clearest pieces of evidence of patriarchy, is that, you know, most wealth is controlled by men.
I think that's a pretty safe assumption.
Yeah. So we should just like, let's just stop comparing the wage gap, because this is just like such a much more stark difference. And yeah, it's really not, you really cannot refute this piece of data where like the wage gap, you know, anytime someone talks about the wage gap, it's like, oh, well, if you control for the difference in the job that they choose to go for and blah, 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 then like if you ignore all the differences between the genders, then they're actually very equal, you know. If you just account for all the differences, there's no difference.
Except when you go look at dominant capital. Like, right. Come on, people. Come on.
When you look at billionaires, I mean, what is the difference that you can make here?
Wait, like, now
men just choose to be billionaires at a higher rate? Like,
yeah,
you're saying there's fewer women that want to be billionaires? I don't buy that. I don't buy that for a second.
Here's a small point where I become a little bit conflicted. Do I need to give a shit about these women? Should I be fighting for their rights to,
right,
to
so,
earn
yeah,
more?
So that's the difference. That's the difference between a leftist and a liberal. Both of us can look at this and see it as evidence. Like, yes, there's absolutely patriarchy. Men control most of the world. It's very clear here. And the divergence would be, the liberals' answer is, okay, so we need half of all billionaires to be women, whereas the leftists' answer is, we need no one to be a billionaire.
Yes. And I think there we have finally hit on, and I've been having this discussion with people for a while now, we have finally hit on the difference between being liberal and being leftist.
Well, you know, I don't like to hit on anyone who doesn't want it, you know. I respect others' autonomy, but you know, up to you if you want to, you know, act a different way, I guess. Man, I'm off today. So they go further into the gender breakdown. They look at the wealth source by gender. So over half of female billionaires are heiresses, compared to male billionaires, where only 8% are heirs. And this is for like completely, like they became a billionaire completely through inheritance. For a mix between inheritance and making money through business, The rates are about equal for each. It's about 30% for each. And then the main difference is men tend to become billionaires from business. So 62% make their billions from business, and only 17% of women do so. So in the report, they say, I've been saying make their billions through business. The report says self-made, and I have a problem with that term because, one, it implies that they got that money through their effort alone, which, I mean, anyone listening to the show hopefully knows that that's bullshit. And then even if we say that they made their money, no $1 billion company ascends to that status without capital from other wealthy people. So that means that those currently in control exert a significant degree of influence over who enters their class.
I'm not going to lie to you. All of these statistics are really depressing.
Yeah. So because most men got their billions through business, that means that most men are getting their billions at the behest of other men who they are not related to. So women are getting their billions through people that they are related to, presumably men that they're related to. Whereas men receive most of their money through their social connections and through building up businesses. So I think that's just further evidence that men exert far more control over the social, political, economic system than women do.
Yeah, definitely.
And so one more demographic thing I wanted to touch on. They don't break down billionaires by race, but I tried to make a kind of a proxy for that. There's no way that we'll be able to know how many billionaires are like Black Americans, but if we look globally by continent, I think it's pretty safe to assume the race of each continent, like the dominant race of each continent, and so we can look at billionaire wealth that way. So North America and Europe combined, which I'm treating as the white countries, for population, whites are 56% of the billionaire population, owning 62% of billionaire wealth. Asians are 30% of the billionaire population, owning 26.5% of billionaire wealth. Latinx people are only 6% of billionaires, owning 5% of billionaire wealth. Brown people are 6% of the billionaire population, owning 5% of billionaire wealth. And then black people are 1.6% of billionaire population, and they only own 1% of billionaire wealth. So there's a very clear racial disparity where even white people own an outsized amount of the billionaire wealth in relation to their population size, on top of being half of the population, despite being a global, racial minority. And then black people are only 1.6% of the billionaire population, but they own only 1% of its wealth. So they own less wealth per person than whites do.
You've got to give capitalism its props. When it sticks to its guns, it really sticks to its guns.
I'm reminded of the drill tweet. No, in fact, you do not have to hand it to ISIS or something like that. So the last thing in the billionaire census, they went into the interests of billionaires. So for their hobbies, 59% of billionaires said they were interested or had as a hobby business, which is surprisingly low, only only 60% of them care about business. That's kind of funny, I think. Sorry, I'm trying to find the page. 50.7% said philanthropy, which makes
them want to punch them in the face.
Yeah, I think philanthropy is just it's basically billionaires going to parties in order to lower their taxes. I think that's the most apt description of philanthropy that I can think of.
Because in essence, and I keep saying this, philanthropy is PR for rich people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So PR, tax cuts, and they get to go to a party at some piece of shit's mansion.
Yeah.
So number three on the list was...
It's $1 million a plate. Oh, yeah, sure, no problems.
Number three on the list was sports at 44%. And
let's be clear, by sports, it means one of two things. Either golf at the country club or owning a sports franchise.
Yeah, owning black people.
Exactly.
They like golfing and owning black people. That's 44% of them. That's their favorite thing. Yeah. So that's pretty cool. over a quarter of them said aviation, which means owning a private jet.
pretending that you invented the spaceship.
Yeah, exactly. The one thing that's kind of a relief to me is only 25% are interested in politics. So 3 out of 4 billionaires don't care about politics and won't be trying to influence them, which...
I'm going to go out on a limb here and say bullshit.
Yeah, I mean, that's part of philanthropy, too.
Yeah, investing in your lobbies.
Yeah, because, I mean, if we look at, let's see, there's one of the pages here is, what their philanthropic causes are. So I'll go into this. So top 10 philanthropic causes. Number one is education, which is whenever a billionaire is involved in education, what that really means is school privatization. So everyone loves, like, all the Bill Gates stans love talking about how Bill Gates donates all this money to education, but the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation is really just a lobbying company for privatization of schools. Charter schools, but it's the same fucking thing. It's just a state-sanctioned private school. Number two for the philanthropic causes is health, which again is just like, one, it's, you know, newer, more expensive treatments for diseases that mainly affect rich people. Yeah, that's about it. Dumping money into research to cure cancer.
It's what's referred to as medical tourism.
Mm-hmm.
So, for instance, Lebanon is one of the capitals for plastic surgery. And then you go to... some place in South America where they deal with asthma-related issues, and you go to parts of Russia where they do... And there's all these parts of the world that focus very heavily on certain medical things. So a lot of this interest in medicine is basically saying, we'd like the world to be... filled with specialist hospitals that we can jet set her to.
So one thing that's interesting here is they list both the percent of population for each of these causes, and then also the percent of total giving value. So I mentioned that education is 62% of philanthropic causes. That's by population. By total value given, it's only a fifth. So it's only 20%. So most of them
we
care
really
about
love
education, but a lot of them don't care about it that much.
Yeah. It's very important to us sometimes.
Yeah. So the one cause that had a higher giving value than population was foundations. And it's not really clear what they mean by this.
We really love giving to our non-charity organization that is then used to launder our money and reduce our tax payments.
Yeah, I mean, like, which of these, like, if you're giving money to a cause, how are you not giving money to some sort of foundation?
Exactly.
Right? Like, shouldn't foundations be 100% and 100%?
Oh, God. No, they all do direct investment. Don't you know that, Ryan? They all go to that Cambodian...
They pay the scientist's salary that researches cancer.
Yeah. When they talk about education, they're literally going and teaching in classrooms.
Yeah. So if we compare like the ratios here, so education, you know, they care about a third as much as they say they care, right? Because it's 60% versus 20%.
Yeah.
If you look at public social benefit, 36% population, only 6% giving. So they only care a sixth as much as they say they do about public benefits. That's weird. They separate education and higher education.
Sorry, but this sounds like something that Peter Thiel dreamt up.
Yeah, well, I think that makes it even more certain that the education one is school privatization, because higher education is just like, okay, they're probably donating money to their alma mater so they can get a wing of the school named after them or something.
Yeah, I'm guessing by higher education they mean they're actually investing in funds, bank funds that focus on giving student loans.
Yeah. So here's by far the worst one is human services, which 28% population, and this includes children/youth services, adoption, family services, single parent agencies, family services and counseling, emergency assistance, victim services, hospices, employment and housing/shelter projects.
So basically the most important area.
Yeah, the one that would actually benefit regular people. Compared to all these other ones, like the other ones are like arts, culture, and humanities. So that benefits them. Public social benefit, that includes research in public policy institutions, community foundations, science and technology research. That's going to primarily benefit them. Health primarily benefits them. Education primarily benefits them. Foundations completely just benefits them. Environment and animals, that's probably also going to primarily benefit them. Religious organizations primarily benefits them. Government primarily benefits them. So human services is the one that would primarily benefit regular working people. So they only care 1/20th as much as they say they do, because it's 28.8% population, 1.4% of total giving.
What?
Yeah. So that's actually the third lowest percent of total giving on this list. Number two is religious organizations at 0.9%, and then government at 0.1%. So they really don't give a fuck about the average person. This list makes it pretty clear there.
Pretty damn clear. That is why they want to build tunnels under cities.
And space colonies on Mars and... and shit. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so the very last thing here is their music interests.
Yeah.
And I'm not going to lie to you, the moment I read this, I started deleting the majority of my music, and I am no longer interested in it because I do not want to be associated with these fuckheads in any way, form, or manner.
Yeah, as soon as I saw music interests, I was like, well, hip-hop's not going to be on there. I looked for it in the list, and shockingly, it's not on there. And by the way, the lowest percentage that they have here is 3%. So less than 3% of billionaires express any interest in hip hop at all. So number one,
mind you, I'm a little bit grateful that country did make it onto the list.
I'm surprised by that. Well, I guess I'm not surprised by that because country singers are all millionaires.
Goddamn Texas billionaires, you know?
Yeah, and they sing about you know, shit that white people like. So, so number one, music interest is just general. So who cares about that? Number two, classical at 21%. Number three is rock and roll, which is surprising at 10.1%. Jazz is at 6%, and country and opera are both at 3%. So that's the breakdown by genre. They also list like singing and guitars and playing an instrument themselves. Only 6.5% of billionaires like to play an instrument themselves. So not a very creative bunch, I guess.
No. But I mean, I guess we could have guessed that, right?
Yeah. Actually, we could also talk about the art interests because that's also pretty racist. So 46% of billionaires interested in art are art collectors, which is, I mean, the least effort that you could possibly put into having an interest in art. It's just like owning money and spending it on art. Number two is painting and drawing, which is 24%. I'm not sure if that means they are painting or drawing, or if they're interested in painting and drawing as an art form. It doesn't really clarify that at all, I don't think. Oh, this is interesting. They mentioned,
before you move on.
I'm not moving on yet. Okay, they mentioned two record-breaking art sales that were concluded in 2017. The first was a Japanese collector who paid $111 million for a Basquiat painting.
Which of course, pales in comparison to the Da Vinci painting that was sold at a Christie's auction last year, November. And that went for a cool $450 million. US.
Jeez.
Yeah. This was actually on the radio while I was driving to work the other day, and I got to work and immediately I jumped on and tried to find out who it was, and it turned out, and this is actually interesting, because Christie's does anonymous auctions, so they have representatives that are there, but none of the representatives know who the other representatives are representing.
I doubt that. I'm sure that normal people don't know that, but I can guess. I can bet that like they brief the representatives on who the other people are, who the other representatives are going to be.
No, they probably know. The way Christie's does it is they have representatives, and it all happens by a phone. So they run it this way so that there's no people that can work together to up a price or drop a price or whatever. The reason that this was interesting is because the painting was at first, and obviously Christie's won't divulge directly who it was, but the painting has gone on show in the United Arab Emirates. And the first reports about it was that it had been bought by Saudi. And what makes this interesting is that why would these two... the original price that was being sought for the painting was $100 million. But there was a bidding war that started because and this is the assumption, is that both parties thought that they might be bidding against Qatar. And and not knowing that they were actually bidding against each other and thinking that they were bidding against Qatar, they kept upping the price because they had to beat out Qatar. So yeah. And then with all the austerity measures that have been in place in Saudi for the last 2 years or so, it's assumed at this point that Saudi won the bid at 450 million and then donated the painting to the UAE because they don't really want to be known for spending 450, basically $500 million on a painting while imposing austerity measures back home.
Yeah.
So yeah, that fascinating bit of info, you know, like how billionaires like to play around.
Yeah. The authors also note that art is actually a very strong, it's one of the best performing asset classes, which makes sense because, you know, it's only going to get more valuable as long as it's preserved. It's not going to lose any value. People aren't going to suddenly decide Leonardo da Vinci sucks and his art isn't valuable anymore. So that's one of those things where, you know, the more scarce it is and the longer time goes on, the older it is, like, the more valuable it's going to be.
But what's interesting to me is that, you know, it's not this painting by Da Vinci is not exactly a liquid asset. The price went as high as it did because of a mix up and because of competitiveness. But it is unlikely to ever sell for that amount again.
Well, we'll see about that because, you know,
for sure,
in 10 years, we're probably going to have a trillionaire by, you know, 2050, you know.
Yeah, probably. But my point is that this is, first of all, this is a very once-off kind of situation.
Yeah.
This is not how the artwork, art world works in general. So once a painting has been, has reached this record-breaking kind of limit, it's unlikely that it's going to meet that again. The whole reason one person was able to outbid everyone else is because everyone else has already said, I'm not willing to pay that much money. So
right.
It does get to this point where this art, it's not liquid. The moment it sells for these record prices, it is no longer, it should no longer be considered a liquid asset.
Well, they don't consider it a liquid asset. They just consider it one of the best performing assets in terms of value.
Yeah. I know that the Rockefeller family recently did a huge sale of artwork, like close to $600 million.
Yeah, I heard about that.
In artwork.
Yeah, that's really cool that our culture is all owned by, you know, 2,400 people.
Yeah, that's awesome. Global culture, all owned and represented by.
So that's one thing I didn't actually mention is the total populations of each group. So like I just said, the total population of billionaires, all over the globe is only 2,400. So 2,367 in, 2016. The total population of millionaires all over the globe is, 16 million. So we're really not dealing with a huge number of people.
Yeah.
And you got to think that, of those 16 million, 90% of those are only the, you know, the bumpkins of the millionaire group. Let's see, times 0.1. So the real millionaires are like 1.6 million in population. Is there anything else to talk about?
No, I think that's pretty much it for today. I did include the link before we started recording the show. I was chatting to you about Paul Allen's yacht, the Tatoosh. I included the link there so people can see how billionaires live. The opulence is stupid and ridiculous and wasteful, and I hate it.
Yeah, there's a Zine article about that in I think volume 3 where The author talks about the like some of the things that billionaires own. One of the billionaires that lives in Mumbai lives in this 27-story tower above the slums of Mumbai. Yeah. And by 27 stories, I mean 27 floors, because each floor is about 3 stories of a regular building, so it's really more like 60 stories. And
essentially, he gets to look down on all the poors, and the building has over 1,000 staff.
Yeah, he has an ice cream room. He has three of the floors are a garage for his luxury vehicles.
All food consumed in the mansion are grown in the mansion.
Jeez. There's a rooftop pool and two helipads.
Yeah, because you know how often you have two helicopters landing at the same place, obviously.
Yeah, you know, come on. Someone comes over with their helicopter. What are you going to do? You're only going to have one group of friends over?
Yeah,
you got to have two helipads.
I have to move my helicopter so they can land? Fuck that.
I mean, if you only have one, that must be some fucking loser with no friends. Jesus Christ. Just kill yourself already if you only have one fucking helipad.
Oh, God.
Yeah.
Okay.
So I'll link that article in the description. I'll also link the spreadsheet that I have here, so you can look at the data yourself if you're interested.
And then hopefully both the reports.
Yeah. Yeah, I'll link the two reports. They're pretty easy to find, though, if you just search Billionaire Census or World Wealth Report. Although the World Wealth Report is a bit harder to get to, so I'll link the PDF so you don't have to sign up for their thing and download it from them.
Okay. Sweet.
Yep. So lots of technical problems that we had today, which kind of made us a little bit low energy, I think. But
yeah.
I think it's a pretty interesting subject. Hopefully everyone else found it interesting.
And if you didn't, well, we'll be back next week with something better.
Yeah. Or maybe it'll be worse. I don't know. There's no way to know.
That's what I was thinking. I just set myself up for this.
Yeah, goddamn, you're setting us up for failure.
Okay, so, for those of you who enjoy the show and like to listen to us, and even if you don't, do get in touch with us on Twitter. We are at NeighborSciPod. You can find Ryan is at Handle of Rye, without an E at the end, and I am at BookCheekite.
Holy shit, there's a fucking wasp in here. Sorry.
Do not piss it off.
I'm trying to let it out. There it goes. It was very big.
There's no need for you to freak out and run out of your room like a certain someone.
I'm assuming you're looking at your wife right now.
No, I'm looking at our Twitter chat group.
Oh. Okay. BookCheekite. Get iTunes rate. Patreon.com/neighborscience, Facebook.com/neighborscience, PostScarcityMagazine.com,
Instagram at neighborscience.
Yes.
And I think that's all our plugs.
Yeah, that's it.
That's record.
Bye, fuckers.
Us, later, people. With the roof up, still on the scoop punch, 3 grand, boot block, high spot, call your whole trouble in the squad. Might just go icy my wrist, might just go cop me some squares. Keep a small circle, I can't fuck with squares. Hey, I had to get it high, got it, nigga, life ain't fair. Hey, split the lean all on my kiss and got another pair. Hey, I say fuck no two hoes, man, I got another pair. Hey, bitch. Bro boy, bro boy, bro boy, bro boy, bro boy, bro boy.
boy, yo boy, yo boy, yo boy. Hey, why should I keep jugging all these broke boys? In the mall buying ice cause he a broke boy. I can't even kick it with these broke boys. He ain't gonna buy a pack of seal, broke boy. Hey, RD, Beamer, Benz with the roof up. Still on this scoop punch, 3 grand, boop block, hot as fuck. Call, yo, some hoes go to Lena Square. Might just go icy my wrist. Might just go cop me some squares. Keep a small circle, I can't fuck with squares. Hey, I had to get it high, got it, nigga, life ain't fair. Hey, split the lean all on my kiss and got another pair. Hey, I say fuck no two hoes, man, I got another pair. Dang. Hey, bro boy, 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 bro boy. Why should I keep jugging all these broke boys? In the mall buying ice cause he a broke boy. I can't even.